I'm Joe and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October the 7th, 1972. Thank you. It's a very short introduction, but I guess it's efficient, you know. It's not fair to come in, you know, after a concept talk, you know. Newcomers back there going, just hang on. If you're like me, you got no place else to go, just put up with us, you know. It's great to be in Salt Lake City, and thank Pete for inviting me out here. And gosh, I've just been uplifted by the overall AA in the area. You know, I've made several meetings while I've been here. Went out to penitentiary last night and the mission yesterday morning, and was here Saturday night. And just the overall enthusiasm for sobriety is live and well here, looks to me like. Yesterday morning at the Sunday morning meeting at a shelter, I guess they call it, and I was just thinking of what a great place for a newcomer to be. There was some good, solid AA message passed around the room there, and if a person's at that place that I believe we all have to be at, you know, it was certainly there for the taking. And I see this group and some others, you know, that sponsorship and commitment to that home group is in place, and I think that's so vital in the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll lighten it up a little bit, and Pete probably, all right, Pete has something to say about everything, so he'll probably, but I start off with, I never understood what the problem was, and I heard a story here a while back that really lays it out, and I really understood what they were talking about, because I never knew what was wrong with me. But there was two little boys, and they were best buds, and they were going to sleep over, and they spent the night. Tommy and Johnny, and they went over to Johnny's house, and you know they were staying up kind of late, you know, for those two little kids. And Johnny says, "Do you know how to cuss?" And he said, "No, but I'd love to learn." And he said, "Me too." He said, "I don't know." He said, "What is the worst word that you know?" And he said, "Well, I think the worst word is hell." And he said, "No, I think the worst word is ass." So next morning they get up, and Johnny's mother fixes breakfast, you know, and she says, "Johnny, what do you want for breakfast?" And he says, "Oh, hell, Mom, give me some of that oatmeal." She jerked him up and started pounding on him, beating him to the pulp, you know, and she turned around at Tommy and says, "Tommy, what'll you have?" And he says, "You can bet your ass I don't want that oatmeal." Is that too bad? That's all right. I was the youngest of three. My dad was a big, tall Indian guy. My mother was a little bitty Irish woman, Indian Irish. You know, I was born dead, you know. I didn't have a chance, you know. Wow. My dad had a lot of the same symptoms of mine. He never joined Alcoholics Anonymous that I know of, never had any desire to that I know of. He died when I was 8 years old. He was 39 years old. My grandfather, my mother tells a story about calling Alcoholics Anonymous 1946 for my grandfather. And two men came from Oklahoma City to a little town that I live in, just north of Oklahoma City, and 12-step my grandfather. I was born in 1944, so I knew that Grandpa drank after that because I remembered it and I witnessed it. And his drinking and my drinking looked a lot alike, you know. But what my mother said was that once those two men had talked to him, that his drinking was never the same. And he went more toward of a binge drinker than a daily drinker that he had been. So, I don't know if there's anything about genetics or anything. They keep trying to figure that out, you know, instead of sending them to Alcoholics Anonymous, letting us heal them, you know. They're trying to figure out what causes it, you know. And what causes is an Indian guy and an Irish woman get together and they have two that seem to do all right, and then they have this next one come along that's just a stone moron, and that was me, you know. I uh, I had difficulty and was uncomfortable with life very, very early on, way back, as far back as I can remember. I can remember I was standing on a playground, and our house was just right across the street from the schoolhouse and the playground there, and there was a pickup up to our house. And someone said, "Joe, there's someone over at your house." And I said, "Yeah, they're delivering a new TV." We didn't have a TV and no signs of getting one, you know. And I get home that night, and we got a TV. And I thought, you know, that line works out, you know. I always wanted people to believe that I was something that I wasn't. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why I developed that. I don't know why I felt less than. I don't know why I felt so inadequate. But I did. And, that was kind of the thing that just kind of haunted me my entire life. I used to hang around a grocery store, and there was guys, and they were always teasing me and what have you. And they gave me a nickname, Gooberhead. They said my head looked like a peanut. Now, that's not the best thing to think of when you're about 5 years old. You're in the mirror, and you're going, "You got a peanut." You know, and then someone called me Jughead, and I just couldn't understand that. Why would they call me Jughead? And they said, "Well, because you got these monster ears, and you look like a jug, you know, like I've got little ears on it, you know." And I said, "Wow," you know, and I kept looking in the mirror at those ears, and every time I looked, they'd grow, you know, and I'd try not to look, and I couldn't help it. I'd look back, and they're bigger, and by the time I get to junior high school, they're just going like this, you know, in my mind. And I was so self-conscious about everything, and I was so pulled in, you know. Everybody in the junior high school had zits, and so it would just kill me that I had zits, you know, and I'd mess with it. And by the time I got to school, it looked like a boil, you know, and in my mind, it would look like a football. And so I'd go down the hallway like this. You know, you're not too obvious. You know, you look like your neck's broke walking down and people going by looking at me. I thought they were looking at my zit. It's my neck they're looking at, you know. So, you know, I just tried everything imaginable. Had a lot of difficulty in school for some reason or another. I just couldn't pick up this thing called reading, you know. And I finally, after a period of time, I just gave up. I gave up on the idea of ever being able to read. And, you know, in those days, it just kind of moved you along, you know. I think I mentioned this Saturday night. Everybody nowadays talks about their therapist, and they talk about it openly. You know, it's no problem. But my mother took me to a psychiatrist in 1956, and it was a hush-hush thing. I mean, if you were going to a psychiatrist in 1956, you were a stone lock-up nut, you know. And I know my mother would look in the office before we'd enter and make sure that she didn't know anybody in there. And then she'd push this little kid in there. And I remember the last time I went to the psychiatrist, he visited with me in a minute. And he says, "Joe," he said, "basically, I've just kind of checked you out and what have you." And he said, "You know right from wrong, but you have absolutely no respect for it." So I don't know what that meant to me. You know, at the time, it seemed like that once again, he's putting a stamp on me that I've got these big ears, I got a peanut-looking head. I'm a moron, I can't read, you know, I'm going to a psychiatrist because obviously I'm a nut. So I just kept drawn back and drawn away from the people and my peers. I was kind of fortunate in a respect that I was a decent athlete, and I think that was the only thing that kept me in school as long as I went, is because I seemed to excel in different sports activities, and I loved that. I just loved that. It seemed like that was the only time that I felt some sort of being equal to and maybe even a little superior to some is when I was participating in a sport activity. At 15 years old, the idea, like I said, I had of myself was that I was little, ugly, dumb, and poor. I hated every aspect of my life. And some older guys asked me if I wanted to go out and drink on a Friday night, and I didn't want to tell them that I hadn't before, you know. So I did want to go, And I went, and I'd heard stuff talked about around the ball fields and what have you, all the stuff that went on the drinking thing, and so I was intrigued by all that. And, you know, I got to two or three drinks in me, you know, and I mean, it's something magical happened for me. I don't know who else that happens to, but for me, I went from a little old tiny scrawny tag-along type kid to the leader of the pack in just a matter of an hour. And and they could see that I was really getting off on this stuff, so they took me downtown and just turned me loose like a monkey, you know, and I ran down through the Sonic Drive-In, and like I said, I was a quiet, bashful, you know, standoffish kind of a kid, and I ran down through the Sonic Drive-In there, and I propositioned every woman in there, and I tried to fight every man, and I was free. Now, I'm telling you, I was free. And I remember they took me to a little service station so I could get rid of some of that stuff I drank, and I went into the bathroom, and I turned around and I looked in that mirror and I saw something entirely different, something absolutely entirely different. You know, I weighed about 90 pounds and I kind of stuck my chest out, you know, and it just seemed to be huge, you know, and I took that toothpick arm and I stuck it up and it looked like it was about that big around, you know, and those great big ears just kind of laid back, you know, and those zits just kind of diminished, and I thought, I have found the answer. And from that night, for 12 years, I chased what happened to me that night. That night seemed to go on and on and on and on. It seemed like it lasted a month. And that feeling of being so free and feeling equal to and superior was great. I got up the next morning. I'd been sick during the night. My head was just throbbing. I had a temperature. Wow. And I started thinking about the night before, and I thought, well, man, what am I going to say when I see them? You know, what am I going to say when I see them? What's going to happen, you know? And I can't believe I did that. And then suddenly I get this thought, I need to get dressed, get to the pool hall, and thank those guys for the time I'd had, because I want to do that again. And, you know, I turned my buddies on to it, you know. When you're 15, 16 years old, it's kind of difficult, at least in Oklahoma, to get anything to drink. You have to know somebody and work and scam and pay big prices. And that guy I went to school with, his name was Dallas, and his mother was a bartender in a beer joint there in town. And I got him off the side, and I said, hey, do you think your mom could get us some booze for next weekend? And he said, well, I'll check with her. And he came back to school the next day, and he said, yeah, she said she'd get you we could get a case of beer. And I said, okay, you get it, and we're on, you know. And so he shows up where we were supposed to meet, and he hands me a case of Metz beer. Have any of you ever drank any Metz beer? I knew it. I don't know what for sure what year that was, but I paid $20 for a case of Metz beer. I sent some of it off to have it analyzed, and I got the letter. It said, "Dear Mr. Lenihan, we believe your horse has diabetes." I mean, it was some bad stuff, but we drank it, and it did what it was supposed to do. We just knew the next time we were going to demand, we'd give $25, we'd get something other than Matt's, you know, but. You know, drinking was a lot of fun. I had an awful lot of fun drinking. I did a lot of crazy, insane things that, you know, I should be doing life for. But it was fun, and it was exciting, and I seemed to get attention, and it was, you know, that I was the wild one and the crazy one, and you wanted to go with him because it was a great time. And, you know, I was always bashful around the women. I'd always been just taken by women, but I was just scared to death of women. I don't know if y'all ever went to any of those junior high dances. The guys are over here and the girls are over here and the record's playing, you know, and you just kind of look at each other, you know. And I was obvious, you know. I was drooling, you know, and I, you know. But I could not, fear just kept me from going across there, and I knew if I asked her, she'd say no, and I'd just be tore up. So I just wouldn't go there, you know. But once I found booze, all bets were off, and nobody was safe, trust me. I had no problem after a drink or two telling a woman exactly what I was interested in, in plain, simple language. You know, there was nothing to be left for the imagination. I spent 14 years in school and never got a high school education. That's a long time. I have nightmares. I'm still up there walking those hallways, this gray hair, you know. And hey, maybe this year I'll get it, you know. But finally they kicked me out, told me to leave and not come back, and that suited me. I was going to get out and get in the world and get rich, and that's what I did. And other than get rich, I just went to work, and I was dating a little girl that was kind of my high school honey, and she was a senior, and we were getting involved the year after, the summer after her senior year. We planned on getting married on Christmas, and we had to step that up a little bit. She got pregnant, and we had to get married in September, and this girl was actually looking back at it and talking to her and making amends and developing a relationship after the fact. You know, she hooked up to me to get out of an alcoholic home. Her dad and her brother both were bad drinkers, and she was just tired of all the chaos and everything, and so she hooked up with me, and she jumped from the frying pan to the fire, I'll promise you. You know, and she wasn't Indian, but I led her down the trail of tears anyway. You know, it was terrible. It was we had a little girl, premature. This little girl weighed less than 2 pounds. And she only lived 18 hours. And I stood there and I watched that little baby take every breath that she took in this life. And I was just a total wreck. I never felt so helpless, there was absolutely nothing I could do but watch. And her little skin looked like cellophane, and her little chest would open and close, and just trying with everything she could to stay on this work, this in this life. And, you know, after 18 hours, we lost her. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as a guy that didn't truly believe that selfishness and self-centeredness was my problem. Might be your problem, but it wasn't mine. But when I got to looking at things, you know, I realized that starting with that little baby, I never considered once how that little girl's life or death affected anybody else on this planet but me. And sadly, I used the little girl's life and death for an excuse for more drinking. And we had a typical alcoholic marriage. We'd bust up and go back together, and we'd bust up and she'd get an attorney and I'd talk her out of it, and we'd get back together, and then we'd bust up and she'd move home with her mother and dad, and then I'd go home and move in with mom and dad too. And you know, it was just nuts for 4 years, and finally after 4 years we did finally get a divorce, and that came at an outstanding good time because my girlfriend was pregnant. And I got out of this deal and got into another one, had a little boy right quick, you know, and I don't like the marriage thing. I don't like the responsibility. I want out. Before I can get out, she gets pregnant again, and finally I'm out, and we got a divorce, and that came at an outstanding time. My girlfriend was pregnant, and so I just kind of went into the next one, and I could shorten this up considerably. I had 3 sons in 10 months and 2 days, and I had 4 sons in 30 months. Now, that doesn't make me alcoholic, but I think Jerry Springer would like to hear that story, I'll tell you. Yeah. Somewhere along the line, someone mentioned that I might go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I darkened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in May 1968 to find a glum lot. 4 terribly, terribly old men, and there was AC, SD, WD, and MAC. And you know, I thought, you know, those guys really, I'm glad they're doing this. They need to get straightened out. Life's on the short end for them, you know. They were about 40, 45 years old, you know, and I thought, I felt so sorry for them, you know, and they, you know, they were pitiful. What, unbeknownst to me, during my, you know, frequently AA periodically, you know, they laid on me the true nature of my malady by sharing their own stories. Unbeknownst to me, I was changed forever, and I drank for four more years. During that 4 years, from the May 1968 till October 7th, 1972, everything I'd ever heard in an AA meeting came to be a truth in my life. I'd been getting into some kind of trouble, but I was really getting ready to get in some big trouble. I had a disagreement with a young man, and somewhere or another, he ended up in the trunk of my car, and I kind of forgot about him. I don't know that I forgot about him. I think I was blacking out. You know, it was one of those evenings where I'd come in and go out and come in and go out. And during one of my ends, I heard a rustling in the truck. And I thought, oh, yeah, I picked that guy up. And that girl was talking about the getting paid. I've never worked with anybody that could pay me nothing. I don't know where that was. What the next... I don't know who you're working with, but nobody I've ever 12-step had a nickel, you know, and that's the way I came. But anyway, back to this guy in my trunk, and I forgot him again. We ended up at my brother-in-law's house. My brother-in-law was kind of a father figure to me and my oldest sister's husband, and heck of a guy. He was a school principal and just a straight guy. And I got him up at like 2 in the morning, which wasn't unusual. Usually it was a phone call for him to bail me out. But I actually knocked on the door, and he said, what's going on? And I said, come on out here. I want to show you something. This is December the 26th of 1969. And he wanders out there in the street, and his wife, my sister, comes out, and one of their kids wander out, and we all walk up to the back of my car, and I opened a trunk, you know, and here's this guy peering at it. It scared everybody. It scared him. It's, you know, you know. So I closed it, you know. My brother-in-law says, what are you doing? And I said, I don't know. This guy, you know, he didn't do right, and I just put him in there, you know. And so we finally let him out and told him to go home or wherever, and all he had on was his underwear. It's December the 26th in Oklahoma. It's cold, you know, and I thought he was looking at my wife or something. He lived in the same apartment complex. He just lived in the wrong place, you know. So we spent the rest of the night be sitting and drinking and telling kind of what had happened and laughing about it. And the next morning, the police kicked the door down and arrested me for kidnapping. And so I get, I ended up through, you know, the grace of God and a heck of an attorney. I got a 3-year probation period out of that deal. And, you know, I don't know about you all, but I stood in front of judges a lot, you know, and I'd always be so drove up and so fearful, and I'd be cotton in my mouth, and I'd stand there in front of him and yes, sir, and no, sir, and I'd get a fine or a probation, and I'd turn around and I'd say, I beat him again, you know, I beat him again, you know, always playing the role. Before I could live down this 3 years probation, I got busted on a first-degree rape charge, me and two other guys. This is serious. You know, this is the second time down for me on what could be capital offenses. And the sad thing about this deal is I had no recollection of the evening before. I didn't know whether I did, whether I didn't. To this day, I don't know. And I spent the entire summer of 1971 in the county jail waiting. I had to take a lie detector test. And any of you ever taken a lie detector test? And I'd never taken one, you know. And so we went in there and we sat down, and this guy started asking me some very personal questions. And the sad thing about it was, my honest answer was, I didn't know. And after about the 10th, I don't know, this guy goes berserk. He jumps up and screaming and hollering. He says, it's yes or no. This machine doesn't understand. I don't know. And I said, well, I don't know. And I figured from that, I was going to the penitentiary for a long, long time. The other two guys maybe were favorable. I don't know how it worked out. But they finally, after 100 days in the county jail, were turned loose. During that period, visitation days, I like to tell this story because my mother was a little full-blood Al-Anon, untreated. And visitation day was on Tuesdays. And I went to the window on Tuesday, and I looked out there in this big mass of people kind of like this right here, you know, and I could see my mom out there. And I thought, you know, I knew my mom would show up. I knew she'd be here. And I looked, beside her was my wife. And under the circumstances, you know, I was surprised to see her, but I was glad that she was there. And I looked just a little bit to her right, and I saw another wife. I thought, wow, that's strange, you know, that she would be here, you know. And I looked behind, kind of further down the hallway, and I could see my girlfriend. And behind her is her husband. And my mother comes to the window, and she hollers, honey, there's been a terrible mistake, and I'll have you out of there as soon as possible. I said, please, not today, Mom, not today. I think this is the safest place for me, you know. Things really went downhill. I was living in my car. I totaled my car out. It ended up in an abandoned house, and by then I've got a paper sack full of dirty clothes and a U-Haul quilt, and that was all I owned. And I ended up living with my brother-in-law's mother, and I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stayed sober. I stayed free from alcohol, let's put it that way, for about 90 days. And I'd met another woman, and I know that's hard for you to believe, but I did. And this woman was wealthy, and I was going to go to any lengths to get her. I mean, she had a car and a TV, you know. I was going to get this girl. And anyway, I on a Monday morning, I had the idea that probably I could drink and still maintain my job and what have you. And I took a drink on a Monday morning, and I went on to work, and things went pretty good. And I thought, well, that's the secret, you know. So a Tuesday, I had a couple of beers, and Wednesday I had about six beers, and Thursday I came down drunk, and I stayed drunk. I stayed as drunk as any human being I've ever witnessed from the spring of 1972 until October the 7th. And it was the only time that I would draw a sober breath. It was because I was so physically sick that I could not get anything to stay down. Of course, that relationship was over and done, and I'd heard that her favorite uncle had passed away, and I went to take her to her uncle's funeral. I just had it in my mind that I had to take her. And I showed up at her house to take her to this funeral in a pair of cut-off Levi's and a T-shirt, and I hadn't shaved or bathed in two or three days. And I walked into her house, and if you're an alcoholic, you'll know what I'm talking about. There was a look on her face that had every emotion known to man on it. And I'd seen that out of my mother. I'd seen that out of various wives. I'd seen that out of my two sisters. I'd seen that stare and that pain that I was inflicting on the people that loved and cared about me. And it just went real deep. And it was obvious she wasn't going to go anywhere with me. And I turned around and walked out. And as I walked across her front lawn, I had a terrifying thought. And the thought was, today's the day for you to stop drinking. And that took me to a depth of fear that I didn't know existed. The next thought I had scared me even more than that. I knew for the very first time, I was 27 years old, and I'd had the thought that I ought to stop. I had the thought to probably stop today. I'd had that thought before, but not like that. But then this next thought that I had was the first time I'd ever had this thought. I knew for the very first time that there was absolutely no way that I could stop drinking. And, you know, it was a terrifying thing to me. I'd stood in front of judges twice on capital offenses. I'd been in all kinds of situations and fearful. I thought I knew what fear was, but no fear could compare with the fear that those two thoughts brought onto me that day. I went to a friend's apartment and I started up through what I hoped to be the last sobering up process. And that was a Friday. On the following Sunday, I was feeling a little bit better. And I called this girl and I asked her to go to a movie. We went to a movie in downtown Oklahoma City. And she loved movies and I couldn't stand movies, but I was willing to do anything to get back in the house, you know. And I hadn't drank since sometime Thursday night or Friday morning early. And anyway, we went to this theater, and this movie was kind of like your first AA meeting. It was about 36 hours long. It just went on and on and on. And at about halfway through this meeting, or this movie, I start sweating. I mean, I got wringing wet, and it seemed just come on me. And then I got cold and I began to shake and shiver, and I'd had DTs before and I knew what was fixing to come on, and I was trying to hold myself in this theater seat. I mean, I was vibrating so bad, and this was an old theater and that old seat was rattling and squeaking and making all kinds of racket, and people in the theater would turn around and looking, you know. I'm cool even in DTs. I start turning around and looking, you know, what is that, you know, and finally, that movie's over, and I run out into the foyer with this woman, and who do I run into but the man that had 12-stepped me on four different occasions. And he said, "Joe, how you doing?" And I said, "Fine." And he said, "What'd you do about your drinking?" And I said, "Well, I quit." And he said, "When?" And I said, "Friday." With authority, you know. And he took me to his home, and he began to try to get some food in me, he put Cairo syrup and orange juice and mixed it up, and oh my God, you know, it seemed I could hardly get it down, but it seemed to be doing something. I began to feel a little better, and he began to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous and about what my life could become if I was interested in what Alcoholics Anonymous had to offer. It was probably 2 weeks after that I was at the corner of 23rd and Portland in Oklahoma City, early on a Saturday morning, and I looked over at this girl that I was with and was laughing, and she said, what's so funny? And I said, "I'm an alcoholic, and I don't care." And I surrendered to my heart of heart, to my innermost self, that I am, in fact, powerless over alcohol in my life, certainly unmanageable. And, you know, I took off, and these four old men were outstanding AA members. I mean, I was telling somebody at dinner tonight that there's only two. I was the fifth guy to get sober in that group. There's only two of us left. The other three died sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. The next five to come have all passed away, and they all died active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Unbelievable record. You know, I'll put that record with just about any group that we see today. You know, it seems to be constant turnover. I was talking to someone early before this meeting, and they were talking about being here for a time and leaving. And I think what happens to us, we all come here, and the book describes us, our alcoholism as being selfish and self-centered, that we're the extreme example of that. But I think through the 12 steps, when they're applied to our lives, we have to go through a transition and come from a giver to a taker. I think that an awful lot of people are almost satisfied with just not drinking. And there's so much more to be offered in Alcoholics Anonymous. There used to be an old man, one of the old men in my group, that always talked about Alcoholics Anonymous being open on the big end. And what that meant was that there was no lid to it. And what I've come to believe that meant to me now is that if you remain a taker, if you go to AA meetings to get something, if you go to AA meetings to get your battery charged, if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous to get what you could get, there is a limit to what you can take in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that. I believe that, or I wouldn't say that. And that's why for people after a period of 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 years, finally begin to just kind of walk away from the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous because they can't take anymore. There is an absolute limit to what you can take in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you put these principles to your life, you know, and apply them to your life on a daily basis, and you can become a giver, then the opportunities are absolutely unlimited. There's always somebody in need. There's always something that you can give. You know, the greatest thing that we can give is our time. Our time on this earth is limited. But if we'll give up that time for our fellow man, and that goes against everything that I believed in prior to getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in Bill Wilson's story, he talks about being at the Winchester Cathedral. And to kind of lead up to that, you know, Bill was away from home for the first time, and he experienced drink for the first time. He was remorseful. He was fearful. He thought he was not going to come home, that he'd be killed over there in Europe, and he wouldn't return. And he visited Winchester Cathedral, and he was moved by all of that and that emotion that drove him up to that. And he got to that point, and he said he wanted God, and he felt God's presence. And then he goes on to say, but that was soon blotted out by worldly clamors. That's a powerful, powerful thing. And I think when Bill finally got to his crossroads, he knew, number one, that he had to devise something to get us in touch with that power. And then some way or another, he had to devise something that would keep us in touch with it, so that those things, those worldly things, the things that man tells us will make us happy, money, property, prestige, romance, all those things will make us happy. And, you know, we get those things, we achieve those things, and it doesn't happen for us. I'm a prime example of that. I had a lot of success early on in business and Alcoholics Anonymous. I rocked around 10 years sober. That girl that I took to the movie, we ended up getting married. My sobriety date was October the 7th. We got married November the 18th. That was a good decision on both of our parts. And, you know, but we really put a lot of stuff together, and we did a lot of great things together. We made a lot of money, and things really were moving for us. And, you know, at 10 years, everything went away. We went through a divorce. She and I got a divorce. Bankruptcy was just at my front door. The IRS was all over me. I had about four or five guys I was working with, and, you know, I was telling them about the wonders of sobriety and what have you, and it was apparent to everybody that my life was going away. I moved back in with my sister, you know, 10 years sober. Had to move back in with my sister. I was there three nights, and I never went to sleep. I'd lay down in bed, and maybe you can relate to this. And this is what happened to me when early on in sobriety, and my mind raced uncontrollably. And that's where I was again at 10 years sober. And I was laying in that bed, and I couldn't. And the third night, you know, I thought, man, I cannot go any further. And I got out of my bed, and I got on my knees, and I asked God. I said, I'm now willing to, I don't understand any of this. I don't understand why I'm in this that I'm in. But I'm now willing that you have all of me. And I think that was my first true attempt at the third step. You know, I think I'd met that early on. You know, I was a guy that listened to a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous instead of reading the book. You know, I just listened to some other people, and for the most part, most of those things were good. But in some instances, you know, I took what they and I applied that to my life. At least I tried to apply that to my life, rather than following the process laid out in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which is an absolute guarantee that if we'll take the first nine steps, something will happen to us. We'll know a new life, you know. We'll be reborn. All those promises. And that's what happened to me. I started over at 10 years. I had made a couple of different amends. One of them was to a judge, and he was a guy that I hated, a guy that I'd met in a beer joint in downtown Oklahoma City, almost got in a fist fight. If we hadn't had a common friend, we would have gotten a fight. And he didn't like me, and I didn't like him. And unfortunately, I lived in his town, and I was going to his courtroom quite often, so he was hammering me on a regular basis. And part of my amends were my sponsor told me to go down there and talk to that judge and see if he had anybody that might be interested in what we had to offer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to develop a relationship with this guy, and we ended up being good friends and ended up being business partners. And we've been in business now. He's since deceased, but his son and his widow are my partners now. And we've been in business 22 years now, so amazing stuff can happen out of the action that access takes, which frees us up. You know, the amends, I believe for me, that when I went back and redouble-checked and I made an extra special effort to make sure that I'd left nothing unturned, that I'd made amends to all people. And the people that I couldn't find, couldn't make contact, I was certainly willing to do whatever I could whenever I met them. My first business was a little old tiny service station in this little town. And one of the ladies that had been traded at that service station was a lady that I'd had a little dealings with her daughter, and she didn't think much of me. And I made amends to her, started having a decent relationship with that woman. And unbeknownst to me, she was playing Cupid. And Cheryl had gone off to Texas and married a guy, and this guy ended up dying from a drug overdose and an alcoholism. And Cheryl and I got back, started dating. And after a time, she said if I could find her a job in Oklahoma City, she would move back. And so I contacted a guy that I sponsored that was in a position to hire somebody. And I said, you call this girl and you hire her. So he called her and hired her, moved her to Oklahoma City, and we started to commit to dating. And she told me she had something to tell me, and she didn't know what the outcome of the conversation would be, but she felt she had to tell me. And what she told me was that her oldest son, his name is Eric, was my son. That when she left Edmond with this other guy, unbeknownst to her, she was pregnant with this young man, and that was my son. And we ended up getting married the first day of March 1983, and I got the opportunity to raise a son that I didn't even know I had. That boy has been trying to stay here with us for the last 10 years and has not been successful to date. He afforded me my first grandchild, a little girl, and this little girl has absolutely changed my life. When she was 3 years old, we were laying watching cartoons, and she was on my shoulders, and we were watching cartoons, and she looked up to me, and she said, Papa, you're my best friend. And she went into a part of me that I thought that I'd shut off from the rest of the world. And I found out that it is okay to be vulnerable and to love somebody absolutely without any notion, you know, without any, with no strings attached. Unconditional love. That's what that girl brought to me. I've had an unbelievable run for the last 35 years. If I can make it till October the 7th, I'll have 36 years of an unbelievable life. I've never left Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have absolutely no plans. I just sold a business. I'm free. My sponsor says that now that I'm going to work full-time for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to do that for fun and for free. And I ought to thank God every day for that opportunity. I thank you so much for making me feel so at home in Salt Lake City. And more importantly, I think let me know that Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well in Salt Lake City. And someone walking through that door there has every opportunity to have the life that I've had. And it just doesn't get any better than that. Thank you so much.